Good morning and welcome to the Wednesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. The 19 Best Foods for Health and Happiness by Nancy Rones for Health.com. If a single food was guaranteed to make you instantly slim or happy or end your allergy woes, stores would have to fight back the feverish shoppers. We're not quite there yet, but there are foods and nutrients that science says benefit your well-being. Diet has tremendous effects on our short and long-term health, especially when it comes to obesity, diabetes, and heart disease, says Dr. Dariush Mosafarian, associate professor of cardiovascular medicine at Harvard Medical School. Just remember, he adds, to eat a variety of healthy foods rather than focus on one magic bullet. Next time you're shopping, add these picks to your nutritionally balanced grocery cart. Legumes. Peas, beans, and peanuts are stand-up sources of magnesium, a mineral that plays a core role in your body's energy production. It's involved in more than 300 biochemical reactions in your system. When you exercise, magnesium is redistributed throughout the body to help energy molecules get to where they're needed, explains Forrest Nielsen, a research nutritionist in the USDA's Agricultural Research Service. A deficiency may cause you to fizzle out more easily. Workout warriors need to be extra vigilant. You lose some magnesium through sweat. Legumes will help you fulfill the RDA of 320 milligrams. One cup of white beans has 134 milligrams. Even a cup of frozen peas delivers 35 milligrams. Spinach. If you're more a salad type than a carnivore, spinach is one of your best go-to sources for iron, which helps deliver energy-sustaining oxygen to your cells. Add vitamin C-rich foods like strawberries or oranges to your meal to improve absorption. Quinoa. Step away from the rice and breads, which can cause blood sugar crashes that leave you dragging. A better substitute? Quinoa, a complex carb that can give you a steady stream of energy. Quinoa is one of the rare plant-based foods that contains all 9 of the essential amino acids that your body can't make itself. Amino acids are crucial for protein synthesis, the key to building muscle. When you build muscle mass, you can also increase your energy reserves and potentially your endurance, says Darren Willoughby, director of the Exercise and Biochemical Nutrition Laboratory at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. Tomatoes. Here, it's all about the antioxidant lycopene. Our research showed that lycopene reduced inflammation in the lungs and the number of cells that secrete mucus. Both are responses to allergens, says co-author Lisa Wood, a nutritional biochemist and senior lecturer at the University of Newcastle in Australia. Although it was an animal study and more research is needed, eating concentrated sources of lycopene, cooked tomatoes are a better source than raw ones, may help allergy sufferers breathe easier. Vitamin D fortified milk. Folks with lower levels of vitamin D are more prone to wheezing and asthma, reports an article in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology. There's preliminary evidence suggesting that vitamin D has a protective effect against the severity of asthma symptoms and sensitivity to allergies, Wood says. Besides fortified milk and OJ, salmon and tuna are good bets. Apples. America's favorite fruit contains the mighty flavonoid quercetin, an antioxidant that may act as a natural antihistamine and block substances that cause allergy symptoms, according to an article in the Journal of Biological Regulators and Homeostatic Agents. Be sure to eat the skin, too, so you're not peeling away the majority of the quercetin. Walnuts. Walnuts are one of the richest dietary sources of serotonin, a chemical in your noggin that helps create calm and happiness. Providing new evidence that serotonin may be directly absorbed from food into the body, a recent Spanish study found that those who ate a daily 1-ounce combo of walnuts, hazelnuts, and almonds had more of this feel-good substance than a nut-free group. Salmon. If you've been feeling negative lately, you may want to go fishing for the long-chain omega-3 fatty acids, EPA and DHA. While all omega-3s are healthy, you get the most benefit from EPA and DHA, found in salmon, tuna, and other fatty fish. We found people who reported low mood, irritability, and worrying generally had decreased levels of EPA and DHA, says Dr. Matthew Muldoon, professor of medicine and psychology at the University of Pittsburgh. Adding foods high in these fatty acids, typically along with other treatments, actually improved the mood of depressed patients, Muldoon says. Enriched cereal. Your breakfast cereal is the easiest way to get 100% of the daily amount of folic acid, the synthetic form of the B vitamin folate. Replenishing folate in people who are deficient can reverse depressive symptoms, says Dr. David Mishulin, associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Today, many cereals are fortified with folic acid, making it easier to meet the 400 microgram RDA than it was when the best source was liver. Berries. These superfruits help stave off the brain aging that can lead to slower thought processing. Thank the anthocyanins, antioxidants that lend berries their hues. These substances may work with other compounds in the fruit to block enzymes that short-circuit normal communication between brain cells. Since each type of berry has its own mix of phytochemicals, go for a variety. Eggs. You might keep memory scramble at bay with eggs. The yolks are high in choline, a key nutrient required to make the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. It helps with signaling between memory-supporting neurons. In our study, people who met the recommended levels of choline performed better on memory tests than those who didn't, says Rhoda Au, a research professor of neurology at Boston University School of Medicine. The daily recommendation is 425 milligrams. Two eggs have about 300 milligrams. Clams. How about some B12 on the half shell? Important for normal brain function, vitamin B12 is particularly plentiful in clams and mussels. Research has linked low levels to cognitive problems. If steamers aren't your thing, get your B12 from salmon, tuna, lobster, or beef. Oranges. People who sneak more C, essential for collagen production, into their diets have less chance of a dry, lined appearance, reports a study in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. An 8-ounce glass of OJ will put you over the RDA, which is 75 milligrams. You can also get this skin saver from mango, 60 milligrams in a cup, or a slice of watermelon, 23 milligrams. Cayenne pepper. Kick up weight loss naturally. This fiery red powder can fuel your slim down by curbing your appetite and increasing calorie burn during digestion, according to Purdue University researchers. Parsley. Don't skip that garnish. Fresh or dried parsley is an amazing source of vitamin K, which is needed for healthy blood clotting, reducing inflammation, and keeping up your bone strength to prevent osteoporosis. Turmeric. Found in curry powder, turmeric contains curcumin, a yellow pigment that's been shown in animals to combat free radical and inflammatory damage, which could help protect against memory loss, says Greg Cole, professor of neurology and associate director of the UCLA Alzheimer's Center. Green tea. Stay ahead of midlife bulge with green tea. Giving obese mice a compound in green tea slowed their weight gain, according to Penn State scientists. Red wine. Research suggests ruby-toned vino offers protection from the sun's aging rays, says Los Angeles-based dermatologist Dr. Jessica Wu. And finally, coffee. Beat brain fog with Java. Caffeinated coffee raises levels of a hormone linked to improved memory, reports the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. This article originally appeared on health.com. The White House is using John Kelly's dead son to criticize Obama, by Alana Abramson. President Trump doubled down on his assertion that his predecessor didn't call the families of fallen soldiers, citing the death of his chief of staff's son in Afghanistan. Speaking with Fox News' Brian Kilmeade on Tuesday, Trump again suggested that President Obama didn't call military families, a claim that members of the Obama administration had rebutted. He then referenced White House Chief of Staff John Kelly's son, Robert Michael Kelly, who was killed in Afghanistan in 2010 at the age of 29. Now, as far as other representatives, I don't know. I mean, you could ask General Kelly, did he get a call from Obama, he continued. You could ask other people. I don't know what Obama's policy was. I write letters and I also call. The remarks thrust Kelly's son into the spotlight, leading to multiple stories about Obama's response to Kelly's loss. Obama's office declined to comment, but in May 2011, the Obamas held a breakfast for Gold Star families who had lost soldiers overseas. A person familiar with the breakfast confirmed to Time that Kelly and his wife sat with then-First Lady Michelle Obama at the event. In the past, Kelly has avoided talking about his son's death, telling a Marine officer introducing him in a speech not to mention it, and writing to the Washington Post that he did not want to draw too much attention to it. We are only one of 5,500 American families who have suffered the loss of a child in this war, he wrote in an email to the Post for that article. The death of my boy simply cannot be made to seem any more tragic than any other's. He had a similar response to the Boston Globe. We are not inclined to make ourselves out to be any different just because I'm a lieutenant general in the Marines, he said. Trump made the initial claim that Obama did not call the families of fallen soldiers when he was asked if he was going to call the four U.S. Army Special Operations commandos killed in an ambush in Niger earlier this month. Tuesday evening, the White House said that Trump had placed these calls to the family members and offered his condolences.
Game of Thrones star Lena Headey says furious Harvey Weinstein sexually harassed her. By Megan McCluskey. Lena Headey just became the latest actor to accuse Harvey Weinstein of sexual harassment. The Game of Thrones star took to Twitter Tuesday to share the story of two separate occasions when the longtime Hollywood producer allegedly made unwanted sexual advances toward her. The first incident reportedly occurred when she attended the 2005 Venice Film Festival for the premiere of The Brothers Grimm. At one point, Harvey asked me to take a walk down to the water, she wrote. I walked down with him and he stopped and made some suggestive comment, a gesture. I just laughed it off. I was genuinely shocked. Headey said there was a second incident that occurred when she met up with Weinstein for breakfast during her trip to Los Angeles, and he asked her to go up to his hotel room with him. We walked to the lift and the energy shifted. My whole body went into high alert. The lift was going up and I said to Harvey, I'm not interested in anything other than work, she wrote. I had such a strong sense of don't come near me. He was silent after I spoke, furious. Weinstein is facing a number of accusations from various women, ranging from sexual assault to rape. He has denied allegations of non-consensual sexual contact. Following are the content of Lena Headey's Tuesday tweets. The first time I met Harvey Weinstein was at the Venice Film Festival. The Brothers Grimm was showing there. During shooting, I was subjected to endless bullying by the director, Terry Gilliam. At one point, Harvey asked me to take a walk down to the water. I walked down with him and he stopped and made some suggestive comment, a gesture. I just laughed it off. I was genuinely shocked. I remember thinking, it's got to be a joke. I said something like, oh, come on, mate. It'd be like kissing my dad. Let's go get a drink. Get back to the others. I was never in any other Miramax film. The next time was in L.A. years later. I had always carried the thought that he'd never try anything with me again, not after I'd laugh and said never in a million years. I believed that he respected my boundary and maybe he wanted to talk about potential work. He asked me to meet for breakfast. We ate breakfast. We talked about films, filmmaking. He asked me a few questions about the state of my love life. I shifted the conversation back to something less personal. Then he went to the loo. He came back and said, let's go up to the room. I want to give you a script. We walked to the lift and the energy shifted. My whole body went into high alert. The lift was going up and I said to Harvey, I'm not interested in anything other than work. Please don't think I got in here with you for any other reason. Nothing is going to happen, I said. I don't know what possessed me to speak out at that moment, only that I had such a strong sense of don't come near me. He was silent after I spoke, furious. We got out of the lift and walked to his room. His hand was on my back. He was marching me forward, not a word. I felt completely powerless. He tried his key card and it didn't work. Then he got really angry. He walked me back to the lift, through the hotel, to the valet, by grabbing and holding tightly to the back of my arm. He paid for my car and whispered in my ear, "Don't tell anyone about this, not your manager, not your agent." I got into my car and I cried. Three Strange Treatments Doctors Used to Think Were Good for You by Olivia B. Waxman. The quest for health is a natural human response to illness, but medical history provides plenty of reason to think twice before you try that miracle cure. Case in point, medieval doctors would press a sacrificed puppy, kitten, rabbit, or lamb on top of a tumor because they thought that cancer was like a ravenous wolf that would rather feed off the sacrificed animal rather than the human patient. As Dr. Lydia Kang and her co-writer, Nate Peterson, put in their new book, Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. Sure, some of the stranger examples of old-time medicine would turn out to be useful, while cautery, heating an iron stick on hot coals and then pressing it onto a person's body, didn't end up curing broken hearts when the rod was pressed against the patient's chest. The practice was a forerunner to electric surgical instruments. And while doctors were misguided in prescribing the poison arsenic to treat syphilis and skin conditions, a form of the chemical has been used to treat acute promyelocytic leukemia. But plenty of other techniques were downright useless, if not dangerous. Early women's health recommendations included everything from naturalist Pliny the Elder's insistence that consuming powdered sow dung relieved labor pains, to the medieval Italian advice that keeping weasel testicles near one's bosom was an effective form of contraception. And in American history, misguided medicine ran rampant, especially before steps such as the 1906 Food and Drugs Act, the first major consumer protection law to crack down on misleading food and drug labels, and the formation of the Food and Drug Administration in the 30s. Even today, despite increased consumer protection, misleading medical claims are still out there. We have to be really careful when we're looking for any easy cure, Kang tells Time. Generally, things aren't that easy, so that should make you a little bit suspicious. Time spoke to Kang about some of the practices once touted as good medicine that are well known to be harmful today. Tobacco. During a 1665 plague outbreak in London, school children were told to smoke cigarettes, which at the time were thought to be disinfectants. In addition, tobacco smoke enemas, the source of a common idiom about blowing smoke, were developed as a sort of 18th century version of CPR by members of the Institution for Affording Immediate Relief to Persons Apparently Dead from Drowning. They would drag the victim out of the River Thames, strip him or her down, and use an enema to literally blow smoke into the person, either manually or with bellows. Mouth-to-mouth resuscitation was invented in the 50s. In 1964, a U.S. Surgeon General report would label cigarettes deadly and urge people to stop smoking. Cannibalism. The phrase, "you are what you eat," can apply to this school of thought. Ancient Romans clamored for gladiator blood for strength and vitality, but it was also thought to be a cure for epilepsy. That rationale appeared to be maintained for centuries, based on Englishman Edward Brown's 1668 observation that people attended executions to collect the blood of the victims. In the early 1600s, one German physician suggested cure for a range of conditions was making a jerky of sorts out of the corpses of 24-year-old redheads, chopping up their bodies and mashing the bits in wine, myrrh, and aloe before dry curing them. Now that it's known that blood can carry disease, the risks of drinking it are obvious. But the use of other people's body parts for medicine would be legitimized through the development of organ donation and transplantation in the mid-20th century. Radium. In the early 1900s, when people walked into the spa in Joachimsthal, Czech Republic, they immediately breathed in the irradiated air circulating in the lobby. The source of the radiation was a hot spring that emanated radon. Patients soaked in irradiated water and inhaled radon directly through tubes. A few early studies had claimed that radium placed near tumors could shrink the tumors. so doctors at the time thought more was better. It's like the difference between treating someone with a bomb and treating someone with a scalpel, says Kang. Radon exposure is now known to be a leading cause of lung cancer. The invention of the Geiger counter in 1928 would help physicians better measure doses of the chemical, paving the way for medical breakthroughs that would enable radiation to be used for cancer treatments today. Mud and Hunger, Among the Desperate Rohingya Still Pouring into Bangladesh, by Felice Solomon. The sound on the shore is deafening. Thousands of refugees call out for their relatives in the darkness, wading through mud to find a familiar face by the dim light of a solar-powered torch. When they have done shouting, they sit or stand on the sodden banks of a tributary of the Naaf River, where they spend the night waiting for the Bangladeshi border guards to find some better place to put them. These are the newest Rohingya refugees to arrive in Bangladesh, joining more than 500,000 others who have fled over the past 6 weeks. The unprecedented exodus began after August 25th, when Rohingya insurgents attacked dozens of state security outposts, triggering a brutal army crackdown characterized by murder, rape, and torching of villages and homes. "My story is the same as everyone's," says Abu, 86, seated on the edge of a paddy field. He said he left his village 12 days ago when soldiers came in with guns and started firing. "They were killing people and burning our houses, so we left and kept walking." But Bangladeshi officials say many of the new arrivals fled because they're now starving in Myanmar's northern Rakhine state, where aid has been almost completely shut off since late August. Bangladesh is already host to about 1 million Rohingya, and the authorities fear that all of these remaining in Myanmar will eventually try to make it to the camps along the border, where they receive food, shelter, and medical care. "They're trying to come here because they're hungry. They need food and medicine," says Lieutenant Commander Zafar Imam of the Bangladesh Coast Guard. On Monday, he tells Time, at least 12 died, four of them small children, when a boat capsized near the island of Shatpuri Dwip. "Such tragedies happen about once or twice a week," he adds. The United Nations, which has likened the recent military operations to ethnic cleansing, says the Myanmar military is preventing those who fled from returning home. Humanitarian workers based in Cox's Bazar say the flood of refugees has slowed to a trickle, but on a given day, between 150 and 2,000 still arrive. At the height of the crisis, thousands turned up apparently wounded by gunshots and landmines, with women bearing signs of sexual trauma. Fewer come with injuries these days, but all are desperate. Those who reach Anjumanpara village in the district of Polongkali on Monday found little immediate relief. They spent their first night lying on the mud as tropical rains poured down on them and their belongings. Medics attended to the most desperate. Many are severely dehydrated, and at least one heavily pregnant. The rest were left to the elements.
"Want to look younger? Your eyebrows may be the key," study says, by Amanda McMillan. Maybe there's some science behind the dramatic eyebrow trend after all. A new study finds that facial features like lips and eyebrows tend to stand out less as people get older. Because of that, the authors say, people perceive faces with more contrast as younger. In the study, published in the journal Frontiers in Psychology, researchers analyzed photographs of 763 makeup-free women with various skin tones between ages 20 and 80. A computer program analyzed the photos for facial contrast, a measure of how much the eyes, lips, and eyebrows stand out due to differences in color, lightness, or darkness with the surrounding skin. Younger women had more facial contrast, and older women had less. Contrast especially decreased in areas around the mouth and eyebrows as women got older. Next, the researchers photoshopped some of the pictures, creating two nearly identical versions of each face with varying levels of contrast. They showed these photographs to volunteers and asked them to choose the younger-looking face. Almost 80% of the time, people said the high-contrast face appeared younger than the low-contrast one. The findings were similar across a variety of ethnicities, suggesting that facial contrast, like wrinkles and changes in skin pigmentation, is truly a cross-cultural cue for perceiving how old a person is, the authors wrote in their paper. Anyone who's ever filtered a selfie on Instagram won't be surprised by this effect of contrast. but the findings may also help explain why people often use makeup to look younger. The study didn't involve makeup, so the authors say for sure that darkening features cosmetically would have the same anti-aging results as demonstrated in the study. But the way we manipulated features in the photos was very similar to what you'd do with makeup, and I would be surprised if you couldn't get similar effects, says co-author Richard Russell, associate professor of psychology at Gettysburg College. We know that lips get less red with age and eyebrows get lighter, for instance, and those are both things that you could address with makeup if you wanted. The biggest surprise of all was the power of the brow. For women of all ethnicities, brow color faded with age, so darkening them may really make people look younger, the researchers say. Though the study was only done in women, the findings likely apply to men too. Other research suggests that the decline of facial contrast with age is not just true of women, but also true of men.
What to know about Daphne Caruana Galizia, the journalist killed by a car bomb in Malta, by Billy Perigo. One of Malta's best-known journalists, Daphne Caruana Galizia, has died after a bomb exploded in the rented car she was using on Monday. She had worked on the Panama Papers revelations and filed a report to police saying she had received threats just 2 weeks earlier. Her death has elicited widespread condemnation around the world. Here's what to know. Who was she? Daphne Caruana Galizia, 53, was an investigative journalist who specialized in covering corruption in the Mediterranean nation of Malta and had worked extensively on the 2016 Panama Papers revelations. Caruana Galizia was considered a thorn in the side of her country's government. Her work exposed the links between Malta and offshore tax havens, and her blog, Running Commentary, was one of Malta's most popular websites. In one strand of her investigations, she reported that Prime Minister Joseph Muscat's wife and a number of his political allies had disguised shell companies in Panama which were linked to income from Azerbaijan. Muscat and his wife denied the allegations. What happened? Caruana Galizia had just begun to drive away from her home near Mosta on Malta's main island when a bomb exploded in the rented car she was using. Photos from the scene showed the wreckage of the Peugeot strewn by the blast well into a roadside field. She had filed a police report saying she had received threats just 2 weeks before her death. She was alone in the car and had posted her last blog post minutes before she left the house. Her son was the first to arrive at the scene after hearing the explosion. What are the Panama Papers? The Panama Papers were a leak of data from the Panamanian law firm Mossack Fonseca, which first made headlines in April 2016 after a coalition of newspapers led by the German Süddeutsche Zeitung broke the story in unison. The trove of 11.5 million documents revealed the scale of the use of offshore holdings by rich and powerful people around the world. Offshore business holdings in tax havens like Panama are a way to disguise the ownership of assets whilst making use of relaxed foreign tax laws. The Panama Papers revelations played a role in the downfall of Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and Icelandic Prime Minister Sigmundur Davíð Gunnlaugsson, among others. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, ICIJ, the group that coordinated the Panama Papers reporting, condemned Caruana Galizia's murder, adding that it condemns violence against journalists and is deeply concerned about freedom of the press in Malta. Who's responsible for her murder? No suspects have yet been identified by police. The victim's son, Matthew Caruana Galizia, who is also a journalist and a member of the ICIJ, blasted Malta's mafia state in a Facebook post after his mother's murder. "My mother was assassinated because she stood between the rule of law and those who sought to violate it, like many strong journalists," he wrote. "When there is blood and fire all around you, that's war. We are a people at war against the state and organized crime, which have become indistinguishable." He ended his post by accusing the prime minister, members of the cabinet, and the long list of police commissioners who took no action of complicity in his mother's murder. How have people reacted? In a statement, Muscat said Caruana Galizia was one of my harshest critics on a political and personal level. However, he denounced her killing as an unacceptable and barbaric attack. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange tweeted he was outraged and offered a 20,000 euro reward for information leading to the conviction of responsible parties. Herman Gretsch, the online editor of The Times of Malta, wrote for the BBC, "Daphne Caruana Galizia was loved and resented in equal measure in politically divided Malta, but she will go down in the Mediterranean island's history as one of the most influential writers." Reporters Without Borders said it was appalled by her murder and called for a full and independent investigation into her death. The leader of Malta's Nationalist Party claimed the killing was a political murder. "What happens today is not an ordinary killing. It is a consequence of the total collapse of the rule of law, which has been going on for the past 4 years," he said in a statement. On the streets of Malta, hundreds of people attended an evening vigil in Caruana Galizia's memory.
Propaganda and censorship are reaching fever pitch on the eve of China's big leadership reshuffle. By Charlie Campbell, Beijing. With the bazooka's cold gunmetal nestling between her yellow felt jacket and coiffured black bob, Mrs. Zhao sizes up the ranks of an imaginary enemy and squeezes off a few rounds, causing explosions of red and yellow pixels to flare on the LCD screen opposite. "It's pretty easy," she grins, examining a photo taken on the cell phone of a friendly passerby. "The soldiers are hard to hit, but I destroyed a lot of tanks." Gun-toting grandmas immersed in war simulation video games are just one part of the 5 Years On exhibition currently underway at Beijing's National Exhibition Hall, a cavernous Soviet-style expo center. It's a celebration of Chinese President Xi Jinping's first term and is being staged just as he prepares to secure another at the 19th Congress of the Chinese Communist Party, CPP, which kicks off Wednesday. The show is a testament to the burgeoning cult of personality that has enveloped Uncle Xi over the last 5 years. Photographs show the 64-year-old sharing peanuts with ethnic minority villagers, caressing the trunk of a baby elephant, and hobnobbing with world leaders. China's state-of-the-art satellites, tractors, drones, and high-speed rail are exalted along the blue-carpeted hallways. The displays build a picture of a dazzling utopia, intoxicating enough to even distract visitors from the polluted reality outside. "The exhibition is so inspiring, so warm," says Mrs. Wang, 57, a retired party official who visited on a tour arranged by her neighborhood committee. "It also reminds me the hardships we have overcome. Chinese people's lives are getting better and better, thanks to Chairman Xi." Since taking office, Xi has forced through a sweeping anti-corruption drive that has, according to officials, punished 1.34 million low-ranking officials. He has expanded Beijing's role globally, becoming the first Chinese leader to address the World Economic Forum in Davos, and launching an ambitious plan to boost regional trade and infrastructure through a rekindling of the ancient Silk Road. All of this is detailed in 5 Years On, though the other legacy of Xi's first term is conspicuously absent. Dissent has been ruthlessly quashed, lawyers and activists jailed, and opponents within and without the party purged. For a leader once derided as an uninspiring princeling, Xi is now a strongman the likes of which haven't been seen since Mao Zedong. At Wednesday's Congress, Xi is poised to promote allies and further centralize power to rival even the great helmsman himself. "I don't think Xi Jinping has ambitions to go beyond Mao," says Professor Steve Tsang, director of the SOAS China Institute at the University of London. "But I don't think his ambitions are any less than being treated like Mao." As the Congress nears, Chinese society has become deluged with brazen propaganda like that of the exhibition. Billboards that once hawked iPhones and Nike sneakers now trumpet China's achievements in science and technology, while newspapers and television shows are filled with paeans to Xi. Meanwhile, even the most innocuous criticism or potential embarrassment has been scrubbed out. The Chinese characters for Winnie the Pooh, an affectionate name for Xi, are now forbidden on Chinese popular WeChat messaging app, along with any comic memes depicting the strongman. Officials, businessmen, and academics, meanwhile, shrug off interview requests for fear of being associated with critical coverage of Xi. The use of VPNs, computer networks that allow determined netizens in China to access content beyond the Great Firewall, have ground to a halt. One hotel in the southern city of Shenzhen was even reportedly fined for accepting a guest from Xinjiang. Merely coming from China's insurgency-racked westernmost province now apparently presents a security risk. In a similar vein, Airbnb has been forced to remove all Beijing listings over the Congress. Fancy a hot air balloon ride? Bad luck, they're also banned. The combination of tightening societal controls and burgeoning cult of personality is a worry for China watchers, even if many Chinese expect or hope the current crackdown is only temporary. For now, most visits to 5 years on are happy to focus on the positive. The exhibition is terrific, very uplifting, says a Mr. Ma, 37. I'm impressed by all the high-speed rail, nuclear plants, space technology, and other infrastructure projects. Without a strong government, we couldn't have achieved these things.
The Six Jobs Everyone Will Want in 2040 by Kristen Baller. If you're a new parent or prone to abstract theorizing, you've probably spent some late nights wondering what the future holds for job seekers. In 2040, the babies born today will be at the start of their careers. Will the job market they face look anything like now? Maybe, maybe not. Automation has already eliminated millions of manufacturing, food service, and retail jobs, and there's little doubt it will eventually reshape every other industry. Some good news. Research from Oxford University shows there are hundreds of roles that aren't going anywhere, like occupational therapy, choreography, environmental engineering, and mental health counseling, among others. Some better news. While some jobs will disappear, loads more will be created. In fact, according to a forecast from the Institute for the Future, the IFTF, 85% of the jobs in 2030 haven't even been invented yet. 10 years after that, the workforce may be totally unrecognizable. Here's what the hottest jobs of 2040 could look like. Virtual store manager. More consumers are shopping online, but they still crave human connection. In a Google survey, 61% of mobile users said they call a business before making online purchases, and 73% of consumers think online advertisements should tell a unique story, according to a study from Adobe and Edelman Berland. Amir Mashkouri, CEO and co-founder of ISDI Digital University, doesn't expect that to change anytime soon. As the pace of technology accelerates, people are thinking about how to bring the basic things that machines don't have, the ability to think, smell, taste, into the consumer journey, he says. In a digital world, you lose some of that capability. In the future, brands will try to inject humanity into their digital spaces with customer outreach and data-driven site design, says Steve Cardigan, co-founder of ISDI. Ironically, they'll need humans for that. The customer is now a set of eyeballs, he says. The role of community manager, someone who engages and delights customers in a digital world the same way as the retail store manager, is going to explode. Robot mediator. Sure, robots are disrupting some industries, but in others they're actually just making humans better at their jobs. The robots in Amazon's warehouses, which buzz around the company's fulfillment centers and help workers find and carry items, is a perfect example. As robot-human partnerships become more common, complications will arise and could create some surprising ancillary jobs. Some, like robot repair, already exist. Others, like robot counselor, do not. Despite fears of automation taking away jobs, the need for skilled humans to operate, utilize, and advance technologies will remain unequivocally necessary, says Alan Stokalski, chief digital officer at the recruiting agency Randstad USA. Perhaps AI therapists will be the next evolution in mental health professionals, helping workers cope with their non-human colleagues. Robot trainer. Machine learning, which uses algorithms to train computers to, say, make a Spotify playlist, was once a skill known by an elite few. The programmers in those roles today are still some of the most sought-after professionals out there, but new technology has made becoming one more accessible. Eventually, the algorithms that control those functions will become standardized, and the jobs tasked with interfacing with them could feasibly go to low-level workers, says Avi Flumbaum, dean of the coding bootcamp Flatiron School. You don't need to understand a robot to program routines into a robot, he says. As software becomes commoditized, I can see this becoming the entry-level job of the future, like working with an Excel spreadsheet. Drone traffic controller. In 2016, more than 670,000 drones were registered with the federal government. With Amazon and Google testing ways to deliver packages by drone, corporate job openings in this field are an inevitability. Future drone pilots are already enrolling at unmanned vehicle specialty schools. By 2040, they'll need to be regulated by an air traffic system similar to what airplane pilots use, Flumbaum predicts. The same way that air traffic controllers monitor planes, we're going to want someone coordinating, monitoring, and instructing drones, he says. Augmented reality designer. Some industries, like marketing and retail, have already tapped AR designers to create interactive experiences for consumers. But soon, augmented reality, which combines computer-generated images with physical ones, will hit the mainstream. By 2040, the engineers, architects, and UX designers who work with this technology will be a hot commodity in the job market, and they'll drive everything from job training to marketing billboards, according to Flumbaum. Virtual reality and augmented reality is still very nascent. The job growth for the designers and programmers who create these experiences will be massive, he says. And finally, number six, micro-gig agents. As the gig economy expands, independent consultants will work alongside a growing number of independent contractors, says Christy Lindor, a management consultant and host of the MECE Muse Unplugged podcast. Lindor calls these people reinventionists and micro-gig agents and says they'll act like talent agents tasked with helping freelancers find and market their projects. People will have contractual micro-projects of varying lengths of time instead of the full-time permanent jobs of today, she says. A lot of people will need significant assistance navigating a new landscape. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.